Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Michael Duchenne, Director of Programming at Perimeter Institute, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you this afternoon to another lecture as part of Einstein Fest. Very full house as we prepare to wrap up our festival tomorrow. Glad you could join us this afternoon. And we're delighted this afternoon to welcome one of our own, or one of our own temporarily in any case. Joao Magaju is a long-term visiting researcher in astrocosmology at Perimeter Institute. He's been with us just for the past month, since September 2005, on leave from Imperial College in London, where he has been a Royal Society University Research Fellow from 1996 to 1999, a lecturer in physics from 1999 to 2002, and a reader in physics since 2002. Dr. Magaju has been a visiting researcher at the University of California at Berkeley, in Princeton University, and a research fellow at the University of Cambridge. He received his doctorate in theoretical physics from the Department of Applied Mathematics and Theoretical Physics at the University of Cambridge. Dr. Magaju has done extensive work on VSL, variance speed of light, which proposes that the speed of light, the famous C in Einstein's E equals mc squared, is in fact not a constant. His 2003 book, Faster Than the Speed of Light, caused heated discussion in the scientific community, putting forth the idea in layman's terms that light once traveled faster in the very early days of the universe. Dr. Magaju has been a speaker at numerous conferences, seminars, symposiums around the world, and has been featured on Discovery, ABC, and in the British television documentary, Einstein's Biggest Blunder. He has written for numerous publications, including Scientific American, and has been featured in articles in the Times, Sunday Times, and numerous other newspapers. We are delighted not only to have him as a Perimeter researcher, but also very delighted to welcome him this afternoon. Please welcome Joao Magaju.
Thank you for the invitation, and it's wonderful to be here in this celebration of 100 years of relativity. I suppose the reason why I was invited is exactly because a few years ago I was involved in this varying speed of light theory formulation. So presumably I'm here to spoil the party celebrating 100 years of relativity. I know you come and say that it's wrong. So the purpose of my talk is mainly to reassure you it's not that simple, and things are not that black and white. It's true, what I'm going to say is going to be pretty blasphemous, a varying speed of light. If you say it's with physicists, they put the sign of the cross in front of you. It is blasphemous, but it's actually physics what has prompted us to do this, not just, an instinct to annoy everyone. So let me just give you, in 2 minutes, the basic reason why we've done this, and then we'll take it from there. Everyone has heard of Einstein, and at least everyone recognizes the hairstyle, that's for sure. But everyone here, I'm sure, knows that it's not the hairstyle that made him famous. It's the invention of this thing called the theory of relativity. And even then, I'm sure there are many misconceptions in this room. Relativity has received a lot of bad press because of its implications to the history of the 20th century. And first thing I'd like to say is exactly that it's about time we change that bad press. And every time you go to a hospital, look around you, you're surrounded by physics equipment, which in one way or another uses the theory of relativity. So there's always a double-edged side to science. And what's more, the reason why people actually propose the theory of relativity or any other theory, it's not the atom bomb, it's not the hospital equipment, it's philosophy in a way. And in a way, what is behind relativity is try to understand what is space, what is time. And the basic idea, the crucial thing which is behind relativity is indeed that the speed of light is a constant. So you can see how we're going to have a problem with VSL. This is line one, this is exactly where we go. We go for the jugular straight away. So if nothing else, what I would like to do in this talk is to impart upon you that the speed of light being a constant is not just a fact, it's not just something which turned out to be useful technologically. It's the fact in fundamental physics. It's the yardstick by which everything else is measured. It's the foundation, it's the pillar, okay? to the point where everything nowadays, even the language of physics, even the notation, the way we put together equations, the way we actually do physics, embedded in all of these languages is actually the assumption that the speed of light is a constant. So the idea of the varying speed of light was a crazy thing in the sense that it's not even a swear word. I mean, it's I thought initially this is the equivalent of swearing in physics. It's actually much worse. There's no, it's very difficult to formulate a theory in which there is a varying C using the language we learn in school, or in graduate school at least, these days. So, not surprisingly, VSL is the acronym we used for it. And when we first proposed the idea of a varying speed of light, some of my colleagues said that it stood for very silly. And it is actually very silly to do something so radical if you don't have a good reason to do it. And my talk is about the good reasons to do it. So it's not just one fact that you're questioning, it's the fact, and you better have good reasons to do that. And it's not going to be easy, whatever you do. In fact, it's quite curious. This is sociology now, but this thing attracted a lot of attention in the press, and there's one newspaper article that's very close to my heart. There's this guy who described us at some point as the punk rockers of physics. And I think this is actually an exaggeration, and it's, it is true that the theory was proposed in the United Kingdom, so that's why I put this first initially. So it was actually proposed first in Toronto. The story starts around here at Toronto University with John Moffat. But the main movement was in the United Kingdom much later. And this is not really punk physics. There's actually good reasons to do this. So let me start with a bit of the history that led to this. It's actually quite an old story. It goes back many, many years. And the pedigree is actually quite respectable. It's English as well, but it's not that bad. And it's, it's basically this place called Cambridge, where there's a guy, at some point, there was a guy called Dirac. I don't know if you've heard about him. He's not very popular. He should be. He's probably the most important physicist to come out of Britain in the last century or so. Actually, I was very shocked. This centenary of his birthday, of his birth, was a few years ago, and he passed completely unnoticed, which I think is quite shocking, given he gave us antimatter, he gave us lots of interesting, understanding of the electron, he unified relativity with quantum mechanics, he did lots of really important things. He's completely unknown, partly because he didn't speak to people. He was borderline autistic. So, and this is actually manifest. He's the father of lots of things in modern physics. He's actually the father of varying speed of light theories in some sense. It's a very strange story. He wrote this paper on varying constants, which in a way is where we all come from. He wrote this paper during his honeymoon, which is a very strange context. So I don't know what his wife has to say about this, but this is one of the things he said. I'm going to read it to you. He wrote, "One field of work in which there has been too much speculation is cosmology. There are very few hard facts to go on, but theoretical workers have been busy constructing various models for the universe based on any assumptions that they fancy. These models are probably all wrong." It was extremely rude, this said to me. "It is usually assumed that the laws of nature have always been the same as they are now. There is no justification for these. The laws may be changing, and in particular, quantities which are considered to be constants of nature may be varying with cosmological time. Such variations would completely upset model makers." So you can see the philosophy. The philosophy is that it's an amazing extrapolation to say that the things we measure here and now in the laboratory are valid all the way back to the Big Bang, to the moment of creation. It's something we've never actually tested, and it could be wrong. And it's interesting, really, because it puts upside down all kinds of questions. It turns everything on its head. And for instance, there is this whole issue. So philosophically, where do we come from? We come from Dirac, and we come from these people who have wondered, why is it that the constants of nature take their values, the values we observe them? Is there a theory explaining the values of the constants, not just inputting them as experimental parameters? So this guy is going to come back later. But I'll explain this more. There's this constant called alpha, fine structure constant, which combines the electron charge, Planck's constant, and the speed of light, which is why it will be important in this talk. And then you forget what this means, I'll tell you later. But it's basically observed to be approximately 1 over 137. And it's curious. I mean, why is it that 1 over 137? Is there a good reason for that? So lots of people have worried about these. And one explanation is we do know why pi is what it is, the number pi, 3.14, etc., which we learn in school. Is 3.14, etc., for a good reason. There's actually a geometrical reason for it, there's a power series for it, there's mathematical reasons for writing pi and explaining why it takes that value. So it could be that the same way pi is explained geometrically, alpha, for instance, and speed of light, everything else, the constants of nature, perhaps could also be explained in the same way. And Heisenberg was the guy who first proposed, why not explain them by combining them and try to find relations with pi? So there was a long time during which people tried these numerological coincidences. So Heisenberg proposed these at first. And this is one example of a good idea that fails miserably. Because it fails, this is happening right now with some theories I won't mention, but you know, basically, every time something doesn't work, you complicate things, and then after a while, it's just you never throw in the towel, you just complicate things. So when alpha was found to be not exactly 1/137, but something more complicated, this is what Heisenberg proposed. And then when we actually know alpha to about 11 figures now, so actually there is a formula which wouldn't fit on a transparency, basically. People just complicated things, and at some point the idea is that maybe this is very unlikely. So the Dirac explanation, which is in a way where we all come from, is that this is absolutely wrong. In fact, the constants of nature are not constant, and try to explain their values is a bit like trying to explain why is it that the illumination in this room is what it is. It's because someone switched on the light, so it's a circumstantial evidence. And the idea, Dirac's idea, is basically that the constants are not constant, they vary, they're like fields that vary in space and time, but they're very rigid fields. They don't like to vary, very rigid, you need to kind of hammer them a lot for them to vary a lot. So they give the illusion of being constants. But if you place these fields in the very high temperatures of the, for instance, the Big Bang, or very close to a black hole, then they become fluid, and you can actually see the fluidity of the constants, and they actually vary very obviously. So this changes things completely in terms of philosophy of explaining why the physical laws are what they are. And it's interesting, you probably know this story. This guy, very good physicist, Wolfgang Pauli, was completely obsessed with his why is alpha 1/137. To the point that when he was taken to hospital to die, you know, in his like terminal illness, he actually insisted on being placed on room 137, which was an incredible level of obsession. You can see things are completely different with the Dirac approach. With the Dirac approach is if he had died in 15 billion years, he would be asking for room 138. There's absolutely nothing fundamental about 137. Just wait a little bit and it will be something else. So this is really philosophically where we came from. And as I said, now it is true that one thing is to say that the gravitational constant or the electron charge or whatever is varying, and that's basically what Dirac had in mind. The other thing is to say that the speed of light is varying. If E varies, well, it's a bit embarrassing, but it's not a big disaster. If C varies, everything else is going to crash. So it's actually quite a serious claim to make. So let me give you like, I don't know, 5-minute tutorial on relativity to give you some kind of insight for, you know, why is this so important? Why is this the pillar of physics? Why is the constancy of C so important? And this is really 1905. We go back to this guy, Peyton Clark, what is going on? And the essential idea is that you have to change the concepts of space, of time, of energy, of mass, of everything in physics, if you want to accommodate the fact that the speed of light is a constant. So relativity has obtained a terrible reputation. I mean, I read somewhere this ridiculous statement, only 20 people understand relativity. It's completely wrong. I mean, it's one of these myths, totally undeserved reputation. There really is just one fact from which everything derives in the theory of relativity, and that's the constancy of the speed of light, that everyone observes the speed of light to be the same. Now, well, this is essentially the situation, the cartoon explaining what's going on. It may look a very simple thing, very innocuous thing to say, but immediately destroys the idea of absolute space and absolute time. So this is a light ray. This is like various cars. moving at different speeds, observing this light ray from different perspectives. Well, saying that the C is a constant is actually quite a counterintuitive thing. You drove here, probably, this being North America, there's no public transportation, so I'm sure you drove here. And you accelerated, you braked, you did various things because you wanted the speed of your car with regards to the other cars to vary. I mean, you want it to be bigger than the other car, to overtake the other car, et cetera, et cetera. So the situation you're saying is that light is the car, which it doesn't really matter what you do. You can accelerate, you can brake, you can do whatever you want. You always see it moving with respect to you at the same speed. And what's even worse, if you ask different observers, like this guy stuck in a traffic jam, Superman moving over there, whatever, car moving in this way, car moving in that way. If you ask all these guys, what is the speed of this light ray with respect to them, they all give the same result, even though they have different speeds with respect to each other. It's an amazingly counterintuitive thing, if you think a bit about it. It doesn't make any sense, really. So what is behind relativity is exactly this question. How can the speed of light be the same for everyone? And it's essentially, there's only a contradiction because you've assumed space and time to be the same for everyone. And you can remove the contradiction if you say that, well, essentially, time dilates. If you take two twins, one goes around at high speed, comes back, the other one has aged a lot more than the twin that went in motion. And things, distances shrink if you're in movement. So this is called time dilation or length contraction. So it's the two things that you need to accommodate a constant speed of light. So in a sense, moving close to C is the ultimate health program because it kind of keeps you young. That's one thing. And then it's also better than the Atkins diet. It shrinks in this direction. So it's two things in one. But that's basically what relativity is telling you. It's basically creating this funny situation in which aging and length are relative concepts. And the absolute is shifted to the speed of light. So this is one implication. The other one, which is not very nice news, if you like, speeding is that actually you have a speed limit. You cannot overtake light. If light is the same, no matter what you do, you can never catch up with light and overtake it. So you end up with this result, which is very counterintuitive as well. You can't go faster than light, which is why my talk is called that. Okay? It's exactly the opposite. And this is quite annoying for things like space travel. You may think light moves very fast, but on the scale of the universe, it really is quite slow. If you try to get out of the galaxy properly, moving at the speed of light, you take a couple of million years measured on Earth. And this is really later on where we came from. I mean, it's not that we wanted to go space traveling. It's that there are problems in cosmology which are equivalent to saying that space traveling with this speed limit is exasperating, really. I mean, it's very slow, maybe. So this is the world of relativity in 5 minutes. And it's a strange rule, but it probably is not as strange now because people have heard about this. Last time I had a birthday, someone sent me a birthday card with Einstein. And it says, the speed of light may be absolute, but age is relative. Have a great birthday. Not sure I was very flattered by this, but anyway. But this is the world of relativity, and this is essentially what you're throwing out of the window at some level. When you have a varying speed of light, yet again, you're shifting the absolute to something else. That's what you try to do. So hence the punk rockers, let me tell you a bit about this. Exactly why this is not punk science, why we have good reasons, the various good reasons for doing something so radical. There are really three good reasons, and my talk is going to be about them. But before we jump into that, let me give you some sociological input, which is, I think it's very interesting, but people don't actually know this, but it's not widely known. But one of the most interesting varying speed of light theories proposed in the past was proposed by Einstein himself in 1911. So the man who created the dogma wasn't dogmatic about it, which is interesting. He had good reasons. He felt in 1911 there were good reasons for giving up this thing he created, the constancy of the speed of light, and he wrote a couple of papers on varying speed of light theories, essentially. And of course, he was living in Prague, so I don't know exactly he was living in Prague. This is actually what led to general relativity later on. But so the point I'm making here is more that nothing in science is really a dogma. And sometimes it's the people who created the dorm who are the first ones to be able to appreciate that. And the reasons why I introduced these early VSL theories, completely different from the ones I'm going to tell you now, but it's just the attitude. The point I'm trying to make here is the attitude about these dogmas. So let me tell you, it's basically three reasons. I'm going to go through them. It's essentially various things, which I started off with cosmology. I'll tell you what cosmology is. Cosmology is begging for it, but you know, other people disagree. There's something called the grand unification. And well, that's also something Einstein sought and never found. That's something we're still seeking in this institute, for instance. People don't do anything else sometimes, but they just haven't been able to find it. Maybe you need a varying speed of light theory for that. And it may be even true. I mean, this is a thing which has been quite surprising. In the last few years, there are observations which may point in that direction. So I'll explain what these various things mean very briefly. I'll explain what cosmology is. I'll explain what grand unification is. I'll explain what true means as well. I mean, it's not an easy thing to say. But it's going to be the three things I'll tell you about now. Cosmology. Well, I am a cosmologist by trade. That's basically, you know, if I have to write a job, I'm a cosmologist. It's a very strange job to have. And it's a strange job to have because it's the idea that you can look at the whole of the universe as a natural phenomenon, like a bridge, like an ecosystem, anything else. And then you try to address with mathematical models, the same ones you use for building a bridge or whatever, where did the universe come from? How big is the world? How old is the world? Will there be an end for the universe, which are, you know, big questions. And this is really where we came from. VSL theory historically comes from Dirac. More directly for us, really, this whole thing started with a guy called John Moffat in Toronto, and then a group of us in Britain, realizing that there are serious problems with the Big Bang theory of the universe. It explains a lot, undoubtedly, answers these questions in ways which are consistent with observations. It also is not a bed of roses. There are many serious problems with the Big Bang cosmology. And that's really where the motivation for the first VSL theories in the last few years came from. The Big Bang theory started off with this guy, Edwin Hubble. He was a lawyer who decided it was much more interesting just to look at the sky for the rest of his life. And that's what he did. It was a crazy career decision, you might think. But he found something. He was an extremely good astronomer. He found, you know, ways of observing the sky. I won't get into the technicalities, but he found into ways of looking into the sky which revealed a world people hadn't seen before, the world of galaxies, essentially. It's a very interesting kind of story, but, you know, the basic outcome is this idea that what he saw, when you look at the universe on a proper scale, the scale of the galaxies, he found that the universe is expanding. So people before these telescopes came online, we're in a way looking at the universe. It was a bit like if I'm trying to look at this picture of Einstein and I'm here, okay, I can't see a thing. And it was exactly the problem. It was a problem of perspective. Until then, you really needed to look from far away enough to get the full perspective. So the world is made of galaxies, not of stars. Stars are an irrelevant detail. And what Hubble found is that if you look from distance, from the right perspective, then these galaxies are actually moving apart. In fact, the universe is expanding. So this needs to be qualified. It's not really as if the galaxies are moving away from each other. It's kind of every popular talk people say this, and it's wrong. I mean, basically, if you go into relativity, what's happening is that space is being created in between the galaxies. Space is not fixed in relativity. So people always have this vision. It's like a fixed space with galaxies moving away from each other and the universe expanding. It isn't. It's galaxies stuck in a space that's moving, and it's dynamically creating space in between things. So the Big Bang Theory is really this phenomenon. It's a bit like, you know, in a city, you build buildings and then space appears in between the buildings. You build more buildings and more space appears in between buildings. A park is built and then more space appears in between the park and the buildings. It's every urban architect's dream, the universe expanding. But it's exactly what's happening. It's basically a dynamical space creating more and more of itself. And, well, basically, if you put the thing going backwards in time, if space is appearing, if the universe is expanding, then if you go backwards in time, at some point there was no space, everything was a point, and it's the Big Bang. So you can actually work out, you can extrapolate, and you find that 15 billion years ago or something like that, the universe was a single point, no space, nothing in between things. And this is great, it actually explains a lot of things. It also creates a lot of problems, and particularly creates this problem which we were given in school, like when I went to graduate school, this was like, go home and solve this problem because no one can solve it. But it's called the horizon problem. And this is one of the big loopholes, one of the big deficiencies of the Big Bang Theory. And that is the fact that the universe appears to be broken into disconnected horizons, regions beyond which you can't see, regions which don't connect with each other. And the argument is very simple, and it's basically what happens if you combine the fact that the universe is a finite age with the fact that the speed of light is a speed limit, and it's finite. If you cannot move faster than light, and if at a given time you have an age, a given age, 15 billion years now, then there's a limit to your range of action around yourself. You can never propagate information for more than what light could have traveled during your lifetime. So you end up with the conclusion, for instance, nowadays, our horizon is something like 15 billion light years. There is basically some kind of region beyond which you can't see, you can't communicate either beyond that region. And the problem, which is called the horizon problem, is the realization that the horizons shrink, become tiny, when the universe is very young. So the older you are, the bigger, the broader your horizons are. The younger you are, everything just collapses completely and you can't see anything of the rest of the universe. So the tragedy which is behind the Big Bang and the horizon problem is exactly, I know the universe will be smaller as well, but you can prove the horizons shrink even faster than the universe as you go back in time. And you end up with this conclusion that the early universe is completely disconnected. It's this patchwork of regions which don't know anything about each other. And why is this a problem? This is a problem because if you look around the universe, you find a near pantheistic unity. Everything is the same everywhere. There's some kind of unity in connection, interconnecting in the universe. So the galaxies are the same in every corner of the universe. The temperature is the same. The kind of stars you find is the same. Everything is the same. And then you ask, why is it everything is the same? Well, normally things become the same because they come into contact. Like, for instance, you have milky coffee, you put milk, you put coffee, you stir it, things come into contact, you get the same properties everywhere. But this is exactly what your horizon problem is forbidding. It's telling you, you can't do that. You cannot stir the universe. Because the universe is completely broken up into regions that do not know about each other. So in a very kind of simplistic way, this is really what prompted us to do the jump, to do the big jump at some stage. As I said, the story started here. In Canada, it was followed up in UK extensively. It's very obvious. You just need to take this rule. So this guy Landau at some point said, cosmologies are often wrong, but seldom in doubt. And this is a very important statement. Maybe just you know, you've been assuming too much. You've been taking too many things for granted. All you really need to know, and I can see this coming up, this is really not very intelligent, just raise the speed limit in the early universe and you solve the problem. So you still have like a short period between the Big Bang and a given time, but you have much faster ability to communicate, and therefore you can open up the horizons and bring everything together into contact. You can unify the whole universe, explain why it's the same everywhere, if you just break this rule number one. So this is very simplistic, of course. This was the starting point, and indeed I was terribly hangover when I had this first insight, so you don't need to be, it's a long story, but. But what is not obvious is that you can actually come up with a theory which is, you know, reasonably consistent, and they become more and more consistent. And you can explain not just the horizon problem, which is not the main problem, really. I was just telling it to you because it's the simplest one to explain. But there are many problems in Big Bang cosmology which get solved if you prepare to let go of this basic rule that the speed of light is a constant. And if you say that maybe light was much faster in the very early universe. So this is one part of the story. As I said, there are three. Second part of the story is a bit ironic. I mean, I don't know if you have seen this. This is a picture of Einstein's office as he left it when he died. And it's that's a bit chaotic, I know, but it's not, could be worse. Mine is worse. But then, But the thing he was trying to do back then was find this thing called the grand unified theory. And he failed miserably, and we've all failed miserably ever since. So the grand unified theory, which is the second part of the reason for giving up a constant C, is basically our greatest failure. And to a large degree, we're still struggling with this quite seriously. I have to admit, I did this really embarrassing thing, which is try to see what he was writing at the time. There's absolutely nothing there of interest. Okay. So I don't think anyone has solved it, but to my mind, and this is the ironic bit, is that maybe you need to give up this one rule, essential rule, which is the constancy of the speed of light, to actually get grand unification. So I don't think, we haven't done it yet. In fact, we're not going to do it, probably, because it's just too complicated. But at least we have identified the reason why no one managed to unify all the forces of nature. It came up with this grand unified theory. So if you at least, it's a step forward if you know at least why you failed. You're failing all the time about this important thing. Even if you don't solve the problem, at least if you realize why you failed, you may be making progress. And to my mind, it's because, the reason why we failed is because we're really playing with the contradiction in terms. Now let me explain this. So unification, I said I would explain to you what unification is. So it's this crazy thing, which is nearly monotheistic kind of philosophy, that everything should be explained by one principle. So all the forces of nature, gravity, electricity, magnetism, light, nuclear forces, everything should be really just different manifestations of one principle, one force, one unifying principle. And the big problem has been gravity. So we have unified everything else except gravity and the other forces of nature. We really don't know. Gravity stands alone. It's different from the other forces of nature. And the reason is, and I'll explain, I'm going to introduce another word, but I'll explain it. The reason is unification really means to quantize space and time. So I'll explain what quantize means. But the basic problem is, as we understand it, gravity is a property of space and time. It's the curvature of space and time which we see near a very heavy body and a very massive body. And the problem is that the other forces of nature are quantized. What does this mean? Quantized means that they come in the granular, they come in particles. So for instance, electricity and magnetism come in photons. Light comes in photons. Photons are the atoms in the Greek sense of the word. The atoms, the smallest indivisible things of light. So in this sense, you know, the other forces of nature are granular, they quantize, and what this means is that if you want to unify gravity with the other forces of nature, you have to quantize gravity because you cannot have a theory which is unifying two things, one of which is quantized, the other one is not. Now the problem is that if you combine this need to quantize gravity with the concept that gravity is a theory of space and time, you come up with a conclusion, which is really counterintuitive, that space and time must be quantized. It must come in atoms, in granular structures. So the idea is simply that time is not a continuum thing, it comes in drops. So it's like these droplets. Time is a bit like a necklace in which the beads are like the instants, but the instants are not width zero, they have a width, which is called the Planck time. And likewise, space is not a continuum, but it must come in kind of, there must be potholes in space. There must be like a granular structure. And you would see it if you could see things at a length called to the size of these atoms, the Planck length. So clearly these things are going to be very small, but the purpose of unification is to come up with a theory which implements these concepts inside our understanding of space and time. Now, immediately you find a paradox, and the paradox is, well, you can ask this question, what kind of objects suffer from the effects of quantum gravity? What kind of microscope do I need to build to see this granular structure? And clearly you need something which is, well, reasonably small. Basically, because if something is very big, it just skims through these potholes, this granular structure. What you need is something which is small enough so that you can actually see the granular structure of space. So there is this fundamental scale, the Planck length, which is going to divide these two regimes, these two worlds, the world of classical gravity, which is relativity, and quantum gravity. And we have been unable to find this theory. And why is that? Well, this is the paradox. You ask two observers, you're assuming relativity, so all observers are the same. You're asking them, well, is this thing quantum gravity or classical gravity? And they don't agree because, as I said, it was my Atkins diet earlier on, wasn't it? There's a length contraction effect. So different observers will see a given length different ways. And there's nothing preventing me from moving so fast if I squeeze to smaller than the Planck length. And then you have a disagreement. One observer will think I'm classical, the other one will think I'm quantum. And this is a disaster for unification. We have not even unified all the observers. So to my mind, the problem is that we've been playing with the contradiction in terms. We're trying to find a theory of quantum gravity which incorporates a constant speed of light. And a constant speed of light implies length contraction. And this leads to a contradiction immediately at line one. And this is the reason why I think we failed. What we need is really something. Sorry about this. This was something else. But what we need is a theory in which the idea of length contraction switches off at very small distances. You need something which really reduces to relativity when things are very big. But when things become very small compared to the Planck length, they become basically, at this scale, become such that there is no length contraction. And that can be achieved simply by saying the speed of light, which is the thing that controls this phenomenon of contraction of length, becomes very large. So for many years before Einstein, people were not aware of the phenomenon of length contraction, even theoretically, because the speed of light was considered to be infinite. If the speed of light is infinite, there's no time dilation, there's no length contraction. What you want here is a theory in which this parameter, the speed of light, depends on the length of the things I'm looking at, or on the energy. And if something has a wavelength of this order, of the Planck length, the speed of light should be infinite. If something has a very large wavelength, then the speed of light should be what we observe. So this is the way quantum gravity may need a varying speed of light. But this time is a speed of light that varies with color, with wavelength. It's a bit like having a rainbow, which is like a racetrack. And the bluer the things are, the faster light is, until you get to the wavelength very, very blue, which corresponds to LP. And then the speed of light becomes infinite. So this is what we've been trying to do in this institute for a few years. And well, we haven't gone anywhere yet, to be honest with you. But at least we're making progress. We know why we have failed, which is something anyway. So let me just finish, last few minutes. I said I'll talk about three things. I talked about one, which was cosmology. I talked about the universe. And I talked about grand unification. Now let me tell you about experiments. I said the thing which may kind of tip the scales here is that it may actually be true that the speed of light varies observationally. And that is something which I wasn't expecting at all when I started working in this area. You always think it's something that happens in the very early universe that you would never be able to see it nowadays. And there is some observational evidence that it is actually happening nowadays. So let's go into the world of astronomy. Astronomers are very crazy people, spend all night looking at the sky. God knows what they get up to inside these things, but anyway, they come up with these plates, interesting plates of the universe. And it's not just they're looking at the sky, they're looking at the past. This is something I've always found fascinating. Because light takes time to travel in any theory, at least light at low energies takes time to travel for sure. What happens when you look at the galaxy or anything is you're taking a picture of this galaxy as it was in the past when light left the galaxy towards you. So this creates a very strange situation, creates a situation in which physicists, astronomers, are in a much better position than archaeologists. We can actually have direct access to the past. We don't just have ruins, we have direct pictures of the past. And this is what these guys have been doing. They've been looking at the sky deeper and deeper, so further and further in the distance. And this means going further and further into the past as well, because the further something is, the longer the time it took to get to us. So playing this game, you can actually go very close to the Big Bang, not exactly time equals zero. You can get like time equals 1 billion instead of time equals 15 billion. So it's actually quite, you can actually go all the way down to 300,000 years if you look at it the right way. So there is some observational handle on what the early universe is doing. And the question is, are all these crazy theories really that crazy? Or can we actually see the variations in the speed of light, say, by looking at things which are sufficiently far away? So for a long time, people look at these objects called quasars. Quasars are really crazy things. They're really very far away. So this is really on the edge of the universe, i.e. really far back in the past. And you know, you can see they're very different from what we see nowadays. If you look around nowadays, we see galaxies. Then we get this zoo of very bright things. But it could be a selection effect. We only see very bright things because they're very far away. But this is what we see, essentially, if we really push the telescopes to the limit. So this is our timeline. Our timeline is nowadays, and then we can go back in time into about, I don't know, a third, a tenth of the age of the universe. And let me go back to where I started with the Dirac honeymoon paper. So what Dirac had in mind at the time was this thing, which I promise I'll come back to, called the fine structure constant, which had this crazy number, 137, in built into it. Now, the speed of light is certainly inside the formula. So if you have a varying speed of light, you're going to have a varying alpha. So there are other ways of actually generating a varying alpha, namely varying E, but this is certainly one of them. And can we measure this thing directly? So why is this thing called the fine structure constant? Well, it's called the fine structure constant because it appears in the fine structure of something. And that something is actually the spectra of light. So if you have like light, continuous spectrum, if you flash it through a given substance, then the atoms, the electrons in the atoms have this structure of steps. They can only absorb energy at a given difference in steps. And that appears as these lines, which you can see in the absorption lines of this continuous spectrum. So this is actually quite a complicated observational field, but you can actually find a very fine structure of spectra, and this is basically what this alpha is telling you. The alpha is essentially something observationally that can be measured from the spectrum, but it's something which also tells you a lot about the way the atom is built, and also the way the constants affect the way the atom is built, in particular these various constants, how they interfere with the structure of energies inside the atom. So what these guys have been doing is look at the shift of these lines as you go into very, very early universe objects. So you look at the quasars, you try to measure these lines, and you see what you get. And surprise, this is basically the results, a very controversial set of results. But what you find is that as you go back in time, further and further, you find some small variation in alpha, which corresponds to a smaller alpha, therefore a higher C, if we interpret it that way. And of course, you never see in this kind of scale the Big Bang is over there. So you never actually see the Big Bang. So you never see these huge variations in the speed of light, which you predict. But what we really see is the residual. And it's the residual, really, that we may be observing nowadays. So this is early days. It's fascinating, but it's early days. And I think this may be the thing that really tips the scale rather than theorists having, you know, prejudices about this theory or that theory. And I'd like to finish, basically, just with a couple of statements about this field. It's actually curious. The first varying speed of light theory I'm aware of was actually proposed in 1874 by Kelvin. And for him, it was just an observational thing. He really didn't care. He was an experimentalist, mainly. And the speed of light didn't mean anything at the time anyway. And then the year we're celebrating comes along, 1905, and look at what happens. A few years later, Eddington says a variation in C is self-contradictory, as if the constancy of the speed of light was a matter of logic. Well, it isn't. It's a matter of experiment. If you actually look at Einstein's motivation for having a constant speed of light, it really was experiments, namely those that led to Maxwell's theory, so things about electricity and magnetism and light, was experiments that led him to the proposal of a constant speed of light. And then, since then, I think we've been tangled into too much formalism, to the point where we kind of cannot distinguish what is logic, what is notation, from what is physics. And actually, I like this Einstein statement. Since mathematicians invaded relativity, I don't understand it myself anymore. And I think we're stuck in this sometimes. I mean, the constancy of the speed of light has become a mathematical thing. And people have lost sight of the observational reasons why we introduced it in the first place. And they were really observational reasons. And what these various puzzles in cosmology, quantification, astrophysics, they're pointing towards physical, experimental reasons for questioning the constancy of the speed of light now. And I'd like to finish with this statement, which is, I think, you know, it should be like the foundations of any physics statement anyway. Hertz said, "What is due to experiment may always be rectified by experiment." I'll stop here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Joel. We have time for a few questions. If you'd like to ask a question, please raise your hand and wait for a microphone to come. There's a question down here, please.
Would the plank length and the plank time vary as well?
Well, no. The idea was to make them invariant, in fact. So the plank length does have the speed of light there, but when you come up with theories in which the speed of light depends with the wavelength, the speed of light you put into the construction of the formula for the plank length is the speed of light at low energies, so which is a constant. Although the question you're asking is very interesting, because of course it could be wrong. I mean, it could be the plank length is varying as well. And this has actually been considered by other people, not by us, but by other people.
So. Question right here.
What creates the speed of light?
It's a very deep question. So you're asking a question about what creates space, what creates time, what creates velocity. And it's very difficult to give you an answer which is not circular, which is not a tautology. Presumably, you need to have distance, and you need to have a clock ticking to have a speed. But normally, the way you define time is with the speed of light nowadays. So the whole thing is circular, and so the speed of light is one light year per year, but that's a tautology, just to give you an example. So I don't know. I mean, it's one of these things. Actually, someone said recently that physics is never, you cannot prove anything logically. You can only show it's consistent. And the problem is exactly when you start laying down concepts in physics, they're so intertwined, it's actually very difficult to do it in a way that's not circular. So I cannot answer your question. I tried anyway, but.
Question here.
Okay, one point of clarification and a question. The point of clarification is in your 1911 slide, you mentioned that this led Einstein to general relativity, but were you talking about the varying speed of light or the beer beside him? Well, that wasn't clear, sorry. Later on, you were talking about leading to the varying speed of light. You had the idea of segments of space that couldn't talk to each other. So suppose you've got a circle here, and in the center of the circle, the diameter or the radius defines the boundary, and then you've got a point on the boundary. It can talk to the center, but not to the diameter, and it can talk beyond the boundary, but not. Could you not consider a patchwork where you have?
No, because they don't have time. This is not. I mean, this guy could talk to this guy, and this guy to that guy, but not this guy to that guy directly. Yeah. It's too late by then.
Yeah, and I understand that part, but why do you have to do varying speed of light in order to get the consistency? Why not just say everything's consistent because this guy here can talk both to somebody that guy can talk to and to somebody he can't talk to and then patch the consistent? I mean, it's not clear to me that it has to be a varying speed of light in order to solve that problem.
I think it's, you know, I can talk to this guy and to that guy. Yeah, but I cannot talk to someone over there. You know, that's a bit too much. You know. So I think there's always a limit with this. And defining horizons is tricky because of this. You can actually see beyond the horizon, normally by a factor of two, not by a factor of infinite. That's the problem. You can play tricks. You can actually play tricks to try and see a little bit outside your eyes, which is a bit like the moon. You can see more than half of the moon because the thing is going around a little bit like this. But you cannot see the other side of the moon completely. And it's the same with the horizon problem. And you want to see everything. That is the issue.
Question up there, please.
My question was, since the light is variable, obviously, what determines the speed of light? You try to say that, you probably don't know, but you said it's important that it's very as the beginning of universe, so maybe you can elaborate on that.
So I didn't go into that, but the idea is that the speed of light, like the other constants of nature, and this goes back to Dirac, is the idea that all the constants are determined by the environment. And you end up with a theory in which nothing is determined if there's no environment. And you can actually write equations in which the constants are determined by the density of matter around, the temperature, whatever. So you can play this game, and then essentially, you know, you can come up with a theory that does anything. And the question is that you really have to find experimental input. So when I say I need a very high speed in the beginning of the universe, it's for practical reasons if I want to solve the horizon problem. And then I can come up with a theory in which, basically, as the universe heats up, gets really, really hot, the speed of light goes to infinite, because that is the way the environment interacts with the constants, in this case, the speed of light. So the actual technicality of coming up with varying C is not very original. I mean, what we did is very similar to what Dirac and Dickey and the other guys did with gravitational constant and the electron charge.
Question here, please.
You said there was a problem if say you're traveling, a length contraction, your Planck length is going to be different, right? But what if instead of your Planck length being measured the same way as you're traveling, if you turned it, would you not still be able to measure that? Would it not still work?
Yeah. So you're talking about transverse motions as well. Yeah. Well, there is. I mean, it's more complicated than what I made it. I mean, I simplified things completely. You know, it's much more complicated than that. And the transverse transformations are, you know, non-trivial, and we have to work it out as well. Yeah.
And we'll take one more question there, please.
If the speed of light is infinite, doesn't that destroy every thing that the physicist knows, like E squared, equals MC squared? It's meaningless if the speed of light is infinite.
You have to work out everything from scratch. So even the E equals MC squared is correct, it's different. You have to work out the new E equals MC squared, and we've done it. It's not as iconic, it's a mess, basically. But so I'm afraid you're not going to have t-shirts printed with the new E equals MC squared. But that's a very good point, and it's exactly what I wanted to impart. So you have to see such a pillar of modern physics. You have to work out everything from scratch if you're going to have a varying speed of light theory, and particularly that equation. Well, you want me to write it down? Yeah.
Doesn't an infinite speed just say that beyond a certain point, if you're going backwards in time, that our laws just don't apply at all?
No, there are other laws. You have to be careful with them. I mean, you basically have to work out the new laws. So this whole thing, you're mixing two things, the E equals MC squared and going back in, looking back in time. So the variations which have been measured, so these things, are really tiny variations. So this is a part in 10 to the 5. So it's like on the fifth figure. So anything which is relevant for astronomy really doesn't change very much. There is a look back time, but the speed of light is a bit larger, but it's like the fifth figure is a bit higher, not very much. It's only when you go into the very early universe that things are completely different. And then it's not an observational problem because we can't see it directly. It's a problem for theorists. And as I said, we have to work out every single law from scratch in every theory. You can't just say the laws, you know, everything is meaningless. Everything is different. That's what happens.
And on that note, I'd like to thank Dr. Magesu for a very stimulating talk. Thank you. Just a couple of quick things before